Hello and welcome to Savor. I'm Annie Reese.
And I'm Lauren Vogelbaum, and we've got another bonus episode for you today.
Another one?
Another one! Just when you thought you were rid of them.
Never be rid of them. Bonus episodes of Savor will haunt your podcast queue forever. That was our evil plan all along.
We're going to present you with more content!
No! I think that is a thing. Entertainment overload? It's a thing. Anyway, this is a positive thing.
Yes, because absolutely.
It's a wonderful interview we did, like, out in the woods.
Oh, yeah. We were interviewing Jamie Ager of Hickory Nut Gap Farms, which he's a fourth-generation farmer, and he invited us out to his farm, and our podcast studio for the day was, like, in a glen of the woods with a babbling brook next to us. We were sitting on rocks. So if you hear a lot of those nature noises in this one, it's because we were having a beautiful time.
Yeah, we didn't ask Super Producer Dylan to add those in. It really happened. We have pictures to prove it.
Yes.
But this was another great interview that we were fortunate enough to get, and we thought that we would share it with you.
So here we go. How did the farm start out? Four generations, goodness.
Well, my great-grandparents moved here in 1916, and my great-grandfather was a minister. He was a Presbyterian minister from the northern suburbs of Chicago, and he fell in love with a banker's daughter, my great-grandmother, who was Elizabeth Skinner Kramer McClure, and they came through Western North Carolina on their honeymoon, and they found this farm, and it was owned at that time by an 80-year-old man and his 22-year-old wife. And so the story is that my great-grandfather went upstairs to kind of make a deal on the farm, right? But the real deal happened on the porch, where my great-grandmother, whose father had the money to buy the farm, and the 22-year-old wife discussed the fact that the 22-year-old wife needed to get back to town. She was really tired of being so far out here in the middle of nowhere. So my great-grandmother said, I think we need to do this. And so now I've got 20-some cousins around here, and we're pretty rooted in this little piece of land.
It is beautiful. What particular part of the property are we sitting on right now?
So right now we're sitting on, when I was a little boy, we had a dairy farm. Here we milked about 40 some cows, and my wife Amy and I graduated from college in 2000 from Warren Wilson College, and we got interested in the whole idea of local food and direct marketing and sort of raising animals in a way that was good for the environment, that was more humane for the animals, and doing all those types of things. But in addition to that, the farm here, we realized, was pretty close to Asheville, and so we could also do some agritourism out here. And so when I was a little boy, this was all sort of concrete, and we had dairy cows in here, and it was manure everywhere and all that. And over time, we kind of took a lot of that concrete out and planted grass and just kind of made it more aesthetically appealing. And so this space here is just a nice little tucked away area that we can sit by the creek and relax.
I do have to say, this is one of the loveliest places we've ever podcasted from. We're usually in a room about the size of this rock.
Nice.
Very nice room. Nothing against our studios back home.
Yeah.
So you say that you got interested in this in, like, after you graduated from college. Before that point, did you think that you weren't going to come back into the family business?
So when I was little, of course, the farm was hard work and you got all sweaty, and it wasn't necessarily something that you really wanted to do all the time. But then when I was in high school, you start to be able to sort of physically be able to do stuff, and it feels good, and there's something about the human experience when you're a teenager where you want to sort of use your muscles and use your body and just be physical. And so I liked it. I liked working in high school a lot. But my parents never really, and maybe my parents would disagree with that. Just want to put that out there. But I was never really encouraged to like try to make a living with the farm. It was never really making us any money or anything like that. So whenever I went to Warren Wilson, I kind of got introduced to all these ideas of how you can, you know, grow animals in a more sustainable manner, that then, you know, the costs with growing, you know, farmers for the past 100 years have been incentivized on an economic level with one thing, and that's just a low cost, because there's no way to control the price because everything was commodity driven. And so the fact that we were sort of trying to do things in an environmentally friendly way was exciting to us, sort of as young, idealistic people straight out of college trying to save the world, and we can do this, you know? And so that concept to me was really exciting. And so, and it's funny because now I'm 40, and we have 3 boys, and they're 14 and 11 and 8, and I'm still fired up and idealistic and feel like we can maybe a little bit more, you know, realistic now. But yeah, that's basically that experience of feeling like you can make something happen, and make change and be on the land and pay attention to the grasses. You know, it's amazing to be able to see a cycle over and over and over again, something like a farm, because a farm is the seasons and the weather matter. And so every day there's an awareness to how the weather impacts the land. And so, and that's like one statement that is very complicated, right?
Oh yeah.
And so, you know, one example of that is always fun whenever we see like that first really hot day of the year, maybe like towards the end of May or early June, and we hit 90 some degrees, and all the little crabgrass and all the warm season grasses you start to see come up. Or the wineberries that grow in the woods become ripe, and it's sort of like, okay, that's what happened the morning that we had Cyrus, our 14-year-old son. Amy and I picked wineberries. And so you have all these sort of connections to the land over time that kind of multiplies. And it's really amazing to see. And then you know, after a big rainstorm, it's like, wow, this whole thing is just crazy right now.
It's green, you know? And verdant. And
yeah, you feel it.
Yeah.
It becomes a part of you.
What about this land produces good product in the end, but good healthy animals in the meanwhile?
So the farm here, our general philosophy is to promote biodiversity on the landscape. And so, you know, in nature, you want sort of a mixture of pasture land and woods and creeks and healthy water. And so in order to have that diversity, you need to have, you know, animals that complement that. And so I always feel like cattle and grasses, the impact they have with the soil are really amazing, because you're taking a grassland ecosystem basically. And if you go out into one of our pastures, you'll find 10 different species. I was out there yesterday with a group, and you know, we've got Timothy right now, you've got some crabgrass, ragweeds, red clover, white clover, fescue, all brome grass, all these different types of grasses. And you know, basically with cattle and grazing management, you're turning those grasses into high quality beef. And if you can take those grasses, and we practice what's called a rotational grazing, which means you rotate the cattle on a frequent basis. And so the grass gets to grow up big, thick, and deep, and then you graze it off and you leave a lot of poop and pee behind, and then you move the cattle on. And it sort of mimics the way that nature has always been grazed, like the bison on the plains, because you have this prey animal, like a cow or a bison or a deer, that travel in herds. And so those animals in nature travel, come to an area, graze it off, and then they move on. And so we can manage that with electric fence on a farm. And when you do that, you end up with a grazing management system that actually builds soil. And so it's sort of beyond the whole concept of sustainable, and it becomes a much more concept of regenerative, because you're taking the soil, and when you graze this way, you're stomping down a lot of the grass, right? Because it's big and tall and the cows are pooping on it. And so that soil surface decay and manure and all that actually builds soil organic matter. And so the plants utilize carbon out of the atmosphere when they grow, because mm-hmm. that's the plant-human relationship. Mm-hmm. And that's just through photosynthesis. And then whenever you graze it off, a lot of that litter comes back, you're building soil organic matter, and soil organic matter is basically carbon. So you're putting carbon back into the soil. So you're regenerating a healthy soil through that grazing process. And not, you know, I feel like a lot of the environmental language deals with sort of mitigating our environmental impact, you know, lessening our damage, so to speak. Whereas it's exciting to me when we look at these systems that we can actually build soil. And that concept is like, wow, that's a really cool about human nature dynamic.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
So if you were starting about 20 years ago, you got in kind of on the ground floor of Asheville sort of morphing into what it is today. From it had been so economically depressed for a long time, and you guys kind of came up alongside the beer scene and the restaurant scene downtown. How has the business and the area changed since you've been working?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable over the last, you know, since my great-grandfather came here in 1916, Western North Carolina was basically sort of just post-Civil War poverty Appalachia, you know, that sort of negative stereotype that the Snuffy Smith cartoon sort of epitomizes. But you know, it's neat to see the blossoming of an incredible food scene, and for us it's been really amazing to get to be a part of that, because it's something much bigger than what we are out here at this specific farm. But the whole appreciation of quality, the appreciation of care, you know, the human relationships that get developed through that process. You know, there's chefs in town now that one example is the chef at Zombra's, and they have Copper Crown too, and they're good friends of ours, and their children and our children all go to school together. And I remember making a delivery there maybe 14 years ago. It was like a big 50-pound case of short ribs I'd had in the freezer or something. And I was like, can you guys take this? He was like, yeah, I'll take it. And chefs love short ribs. And people don't know what to do with short ribs, but chefs know how to make them really good. And so they had just had a baby. And I had just had a baby about a year before, so our oldest is Cyrus. And so, you know, now this past year, I got to coach their son, who's in seventh grade now, in basketball. So it's kind of like I get to, like, you know, we're sort of seeing each other all mold and change and grow as human beings in the process, and not just as like business relationship, chef, farmer kind of things. But it's we're sort of, you know, community, basically. And the community part of you know, looking after each other's kids and caring about how each other's businesses are doing, because they matter to us for economic purposes. But then there's also the emotional friends and connections that really make life worth living.
We have even more of our interview with Jamie, but first we're going to pause for a quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
How do you guys collaborate with other entities in the community?
You know, we sell to about 40 different accounts all over Asheville. Uh-huh. And so that's a lot of weekly collaboration and partnership. and you know, really telling a story about the history and about our philosophy. Because what we've realized, and this was sort of an interesting thing to realize, is that, you know, when we first started, we were thinking about grass-fed beef and how we can do a good job raising these cattle and focusing on better systems for cattle and hogs and raising hogs outside and developing those systems. But what we what's exciting to me is that we can not only, you know, have a neat little story here at the farm, but also because we've done the hard work of marketing and branding and sales, which drives business, that we've been able to really think about how do we change agriculture and the way people think about food in a much more comprehensive manner, and not just the fact that, you know, it's from this, you know, this unique production model, but really think about how do we change farming, and how do we rethink how farmers produce. So we actually now have a producer group of farmers that we have a wholesale side of the business that we work with a bunch of other farmers. And so now they don't want to be out marketing and selling and all that stuff. They want to just produce. And so now we feel like we can go to these guys and say, hey, and girls, we say, hey guys, this is a good opportunity. This is workable. We have a market. Here's the program. And it allows folks to A, stay on the farm, which is a big deal, and B, develop a different model for their farms that they don't have to just stay on this commodity game. And so that's always a win for everybody. And so to me, it's exciting to sort of consider how we, our production paradigms, because like feedlots and all the big agriculture stuff came about just because of the business opportunity that was there, and somebody started figuring it out. And so now people, you know, there's a whole nother generation of people asking questions about how does this get done? How do we sort of understand the impact of our eating? When I eat a steak or some hamburger or something, what does that look like all the way through back to the farm, back to the environment? And those are not questions that people have historically pushed on. And so now it's like, well, let's give that all that consideration, which is a big thing, because the meat and agriculture are big industries. So.
Oh, sure. Yeah. This is the second time I've said this today. Sorry, podcast listeners. But yeah, as Checkers once said, like we've got to eat. And
yeah, you, that's right.
And yeah, it's gigantic.
Sorry to interrupt.
No, you're fine.
I was thinking about one time the whole marketing and sales dynamic. And I remember one time I was trying to sell a bone-in rack, like a pork chop, the rack with the 10 bones in it. And I was selling to a chef in town, and we were trying to get it cut right. And our butcher was kind of a small butcher, and he didn't quite know how to cut it just right. And this is, there's a million challenges in the whole local meat scene. This is just an example of one. But I remember I had done deliveries that day and dropped it off. It was frozen when he got it, so he couldn't really look at it, you know, so he thawed it. And then I came back to the farm, and I was out with the pigs way out there doing something, you know, fixing the fence or checking them out. And then he calls. He's like, hey, it's not quite right. Can you bring me another one? I got this event. I need product. And now I'm like, sure, Ran. Let me go look in the freezer and see what I can find. So I'm like back in the freezer with like manure on my boots. And I'm like trying to find some frozen pork. And I'm like, farm to table is cool until it's not cool. And so like, you know, there is some supply chain segregation that might be appropriate. So that was a good example for me on the entrepreneur side of farm to table is meeting a roadblock.
It's cool to hear you talk about other farmers in the community and what they're doing, and you know, the idea of lifting everybody up. One of the common threads, everyone that we've talked to in town has talked about how it's more a spirit of collaboration than competition.
Right.
What
Could you talk a little bit about some of the specific breeds that you guys?
For hogs, we use mostly a Berkshire, Duroc. We have a Red Wattle Boar at the farm here right now. So some of the more heirloom type breeds that are a little bit more marbling, a little bit more fat. That's always yummy.
Yeah.
And so that's certainly the breeds we use on the hog side. For cattle, what we've found for grass finishing cattle is that, you know, when in a feedlot, there's a lot of corn and soybeans and whatever sort of cheap byproducts are available. And that puts a lot of weight on these animals quick. When you're in a grazing paradigm, you're not going to get that consistent kind of weight gains ever. And so we look for animals that you don't have to take the 1,400 to 1,500 pounds to get them fat. We want a smaller framed animal. And so we use a lot of like Angus genetics, smaller framed Angus. There's a lot of different breeds within that that we use, but smaller framed animals that will, and primarily what it ends up being is the English breeds work the best, like Angus, Hereford, Devon, those type breeds, because it seems like there's the continental breeds, which is more like the French name, you know, Limousin and Charolais and all those breeds. We have a harder time finishing adequately in a grass-based system. Mm-hmm. And so those are the breeds we mostly use for the program.
How much has scientific and technological developments changed what you do since you started?
I think that there's more transparency. There's and I'd say, like, you know, social media and these types of things are the real people asking questions. There's a lot more availability for information. Yeah. And so and then people are really clueless about stuff. And so, which is probably why you do this podcast. And so I feel like, you know, what's like the technology, you know, on a farm is electric fencing. That's a really, like, it's not super new, but it certainly is a technology that we use all the time, every day, because it's very portable and easy to change. And so when you're in the farming systems that we use, that's an important feature, because you're kind of like, oh, it's this grass got away from us. There's a ton of grass in here. We can cut this paddock in half and not have everything so big. So you just, one strand electric, takes 10 minutes to put up, get it hot, bam, you're good to go. So that would be a really good technology. Square for a little farm store is great. That's a pretty mainstream, iPads and stuff like that. But then there's also technology that I see coming, like blockchain and stuff like that, that's gonna help us, you know, take one animal, and whenever it's somebody's eating it on a plate, there'll be some app that'll easily identify that animal to the farm. You know what I mean? Which I think is going to only continue to build this line of communication, of partnership that we really want to promote. So I see that as like something that we want to embrace.
Yeah.
But it's also like, how much does it cost? And and all these techies are trying to figure out what, there's like three or four different companies trying to figure that out. And then you don't want to like be their protocol necessarily. I mean, you're kind of always going to be that, but it's also like, do you have it right or do you have it right? Because I don't know any of this technology stuff. And they are usually like guys that or girls that don't have any real experience on a farm. So it's like,
sure,
you know, we can just stick it on this thing. It's like, man, then you got to go through the creek and it's not going to, you know, it's just not workable. So then the farmers are all like, ha ha. So that's always a good balance.
What kind of, I know this is a large answer, but what kind of products do you guys create and how has that changed over the course of your?
So we create, you know, on a live animal basis, we raise or livestock or farm production. Here at the farm, we have cattle, we have pigs. We have some pasture raised chickens. And so we have a portable house. We move those chickens every day. And then we process them on the farm here and sell them through our farm store and to local restaurants and stuff like that. And then we have blueberries that we do, and we also have some apples. And so when people come out here, you know, our mission here is to sort of connect people to the family farm experience and give them a place to come to and learn about agriculture. Because that's kind of who we are and what we're about, is a place to kind of come touch and feel it and not just kind of read it in a book, because that's different. And yeah. But that's the physical items that we produce. So, importantly, when you kill a cow, process a cow, or harvest a cow, whatever you want to say, kill's fine, you end up with one animal equals 50 different items. You have ribeyes, bavette steak, ground sirloin, ground beef, bones, mixed bones, backbones, the head, the cheek, all these different pieces and parts. And so you've got to figure out how to market and sell those parts evenly. And so it's one of the big challenges of the sort of local pasture-based industry is we end up with a lot of sales on your ribeyes and your New York strips, but you end up with a lot of ground beef or chuck or gooseneck pieces or round or whatever. And you can't, you know, from a cash flow standpoint, you know, this animal, you know, you have a lot of cost in the animal. And so your margin on selling all that stuff isn't great. And so you're forced to make sure you sell evenly, because you have a customer that consistently wants steaks and you're just killing an animal for the steaks week after week after week. All this other stuff piles up and you're going to lose money. And so you've got to find sort of an even market for all that stuff. So making sure that you pay attention to that. And so some items that help with that are, you know, like meat sticks and stuff like that, which also happen to be very popular with people when they've drank a lot of beer and they are at a brewery and there's a meat stick there. It's nice and salty and it costs you $2. It's like, yeah, give me that thing. So it's a good partnership for us with local folks in Asheville.
We've got a little bit more of this interview left, but first, we've got one more quick break for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. Thank you, sponsor. And back to the interview.
Have consumers' tastes changed? I mean, we've talked a bunch about how, you know, there being more information and people asking more questions, but are just like the cuts of meat or the types of stuff that the chefs, the consumers are asking for, has that changed?
Yeah, I mean, I think people nowadays like know what bavette or flat irons. There's more vernacular common knowledge about those cuts. And then it's funny because some chefs, you know, want to feature a local item, and so they want to do like a appetizer like pig ears or something like that, which is great. But it's also like, wait, you can't just buy pig ears. Like that, we also have other items too. Like there is sort of this whole movement towards using the whole animal, which is great. But it's like all of a sudden pig ears become the most valuable piece on the animal, and you're like, this is, we still have to move the whole pork chop and everything else too. So that was a funny moment when we were like, that guy is just, all he wants is pig ears. Like, okay, well, what do you do about that? So I think people are more acceptable. Like nowadays you can go to a restaurant and order pig ears, right? I mean, that's something that happens.
Oh, and that's legitimately great. Yeah.
People love it, and it's fun, and it's exciting, and it's adventuresome. So I feel like people are, you know, more stepping out of their box and looking for that creative, artistic experience of that a chef provides. And Asheville's got those people. And Asheville's the kind of town that, you know, it's becoming more like you can just get a job. But people that wanted to live here, you just had to figure out how to make it kind of work for yourself. You had to be an entrepreneur. You had to, you know, get through the money. Making a living is important, especially when you get kids. And so the entrepreneur scene here and the service-based economy that we have due to all the tourists certainly lends itself towards people that live here are artistic types. And so a lot of chefs were like, yeah, Asheville's great. Let's start a restaurant. And it's just kind of blossomed into an artisanal place to do business.
Do you have a favorite part of the job?
I guess it's changed. Like, yeah, you know, you're always changing as a human being. So, like, always I've enjoyed just walking around the farm, you know, and like not being super focused on, this is hard, but not being super focused on all the tasks that need to be done, but just sort of trying to be deliberate, mindful of just like, let's just be in it and walk around the farm in that space and not in the sort of, oh, that needs to be done. Oh, this needs to be done. There's so-and-so. So that's sort of just watching, paying attention. I think that's my favorite part, is just kind of like just being watching the change happen, you know, paying attention. You get a good warm day in February and you see the grass grow a little bit. It's like, hey, everything's cheering up, you know, and then people. I like people. I'm a people person. So it's neat for me to interact with customers, to see what this looks like, to work with farmers, to see what that looks like. I like to solve problems too. So I kind of like stress. I'm like, yeah, bring it on. This is a good problem. Let's figure it out. You know, and this type of agriculture where the prototypes are not dialed in yet. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like we can grow some pretty high quality grass fed beef at this point, but we have apples, and do I feel like we can do organic apples and like feel convincing that that's a good idea for other farmers to do? I don't feel that way. You know, I feel like we're very humble in our approach towards sort of the concept of sustainability and then the reality of the marketability and sales and the business side of executing on that vision. And so we keep our eyes sort of wide open in both those places. And so it's, you know, there's a lot of great concepts and ideas about there, how to improve things, but you know, there's a bajillion details in that you have to pay attention to. And then you have to sort of wrap it up for the consumer and make sure it's clear what we're doing and not just a concept that has no basis in reality. Like, you can grow organic apples that look like crud that you can sell for twice as much. It just doesn't work. Yeah, people want a pretty apple. And I pick the bad apples out of the bin, but my kids are human beings and they haven't really been educated like I have been, and they always go for the pretty one. And I'm like, yeah, what you just did drives me crazy. But that is who you are. And it's almost like something to do with the Garden of Eden or something.
I feel like sometimes the ugly ones taste better.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and then maybe there's this whole ugly food and ugly fruit movement that's going to have some traction. But my retail experience selling apples in the fall has led me to believe that people like a big apple with no blemishes. And that's hard to do organically, consistently, here in our area.
You might have just answered the question, but is there anything that you're experimenting with right now that you're looking forward to for the future?
So that's one. We're doing a lot of different things. I'm sort of an idea person in some ways, having lots of ideas, which can get kind of overwhelming sometimes for everybody. So I'll put a moratorium on new ideas for the time being. You know, everything from making new sausages in the butcher shop here to trying to do the apples organically to, we had a little project last year with some, the soldier flies where you can generate that. We had bringing in a little bit of brewer's grains and trying to ferment that and turn it into soldier fly larvae that we could then feed to the chickens. That was kind of a nice concept, but it was very sort of rotten space and corner of the barn smelled pretty bad. you know, experimenting with the best way to get your kids to like farming. And so that's a big one. That's a big experiment. Uh-huh. And I'm happy to say that my 14-year-old says that's what he wants to do. It's number two, behind being a professional athlete. And so I'm cool with that. I feel like that's a win.
That's a good number two. That's a good.
Yeah, like
that's
number
a good
one,
choice.
Being an NBA star, or yeah. So I'm like, yeah, that's way better than I anticipated. And it's funny because I didn't really know this until he does like a presentation to his school about what he wants to be. I'm like, really? Okay, cool. I just learned a lot about you.
How do your parents feel about all this, seeing all these changes around here?
They like it. They're into it. Mom's around all the time. And mom trumps anything. Like I might think I'm in charge, or, you know, we might have some conception that we should make decisions, but if she disagrees, then it's just what you do. But we get along just fine. And me and my mom are pretty similar. We kind of like to go and do it and have fun together. And she wears a blue sweatshirt as often as she can, especially in the winter, that says "the boss." And so that helps clarify any confusion anybody might have about the situation. But they like being around the farm. They've been around the farm their whole lives. And so it's neat to, integrate the summer camp and all that stuff. And there's a million things in the middle of it all that are annoying. And they didn't tell us this. And mom, you're driving me crazy. And where's the tractor? Oh, mom's got it. She can't get the Bobcat started. And she calls me. Because mom does all this. She drives the tractor. She does all that. So it's kind of fun to... But in the back of her mind, she's annoyed by me because I took this little piece off. I can't find it. And so that's partly a relationship of, you know, being on a family farm, of being annoyed by one another's inadequacies, because that's human nature. And that's what we do. And so Willie Nelson said you can either enjoy that and appreciate it, or you can get really frustrated and annoyed by that. So Willie's got good advice just about just be in it. Stay cool.
What are some of your favorite things? What do you think makes Asheville, Asheville? What do you love about it?
So Asheville, I think like all the sort of artistic parts of the people here that are want to be creative, that want to do things differently and think about things differently, and how do we think about what it means to have a really crazy type of beer, and that you can actually sell it, and people are coming here for these different products, and it's not just a story. You know, this is like, we're experimenting with really unique and crazy ideas in sort of this entrepreneurial artistic ecosystem that is generating some really interesting stuff. And that to me is probably my favorite part about sort of being in Asheville and going to check out a new restaurant. And there's enough people that are sort of part of that experience now that are able to sort of carry that to other cities, and you see it more in other cities too now. And so it's cool to be able to have been on the ground when a lot of that got started. And so that, and then just the sort of community piece of it. It's still a pretty small town. And so you get to know other people, and you see people around, and community's great because you're sort of accountable to one another, but it's also annoying because you're accountable to one another.
Oh yeah.
And so that's I like that.
Speaking of being annoyed, what about if you could share some message that you think the average American consumer doesn't know, what would you tell them if you could grab them by the shoulders and do it?
Well, that's a good question. That there's more to sort of just an item on the shelf. You know, like there's a story back there, there's a people back there, and we all impact each other, and the sort of old paradigm of regulating the correct behavior is ineffective and obsolete to some degree. And so we've got to find a way to build accountability and integrity and all the things that we want with food, with products, all that kind of stuff. Consumers are driving that at the end of the day, all day long. And that matters. And so their buying choices matter. You know, you vote with your dollar way more every day than you do with your vote. Votes matter too, but you know, there's a sort of general everyday vote that also really matters and incentivizes the type of future that you want, basically.
Is there a dish to you that you're kind of like nostalgic for, that is like, when you think of Asheville, of your childhood, what is the food that you think of?
So I grew up with my parents on a big garden. So that's all kind of what my experience was with, like, the summertime of pork chops. That was always our favorites as kids. Like mashed potatoes out of the garden that are like new potatoes, you know, so they just came out of the garden, and they're small and they're really yummy and they have lots of butter. and then and like you know, maybe some a nice salad, something like that, or some peas. Peas were always good, although we never really picked peas much because we just went out there and ate them right out of the garden. And
oh yeah,
so that was us. And I guess with Asheville, gosh, it's probably like crispy pig ears or like, you know, like what can we make out of this? And so I'll always order that, you know, as an appetizer, and then we can share it.
Do you have a favorite cut of meat? Do you have a favorite, like, if you're gonna?
Yeah, like, I mean, I think that it's hard to beat a ribeye, but at the same time, some of the more unusual ones, like a flat iron steak, is a really good steak for the price point. It's, you know, if I like had to buy meat, which is kind of, I'm lucky I don't have to really, but that's what I would probably buy more frequently just for the prices.
Yeah.
And then pork chops. Pork chops are always good.
Yeah, can't argue.
True.
Science.
Yeah, that's right.
I do love, we've heard a lot that Asheville's a very artistic community. I think a lot of people forget that cooking can be very artistic. So I love that that's happening here.
Yeah.
And it's part of
that. The chefs are artists.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, it's like an artist can make a living. Cool, let's be a chef, you know? Like, I think it's great.
This brings us to the end of our interview with Jamie. It was such a pleasure. It was a lovely day. And I hope that we can do more
outdoor interviews.
Yeah, on rocks.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We can... Goals. We can make this happen. We can make this happen. Thank you so much to all of you for listening and for joining us on this another bonus. If you would like to email us, you can. Our email is hello@saverpod.com.
Or you can get in touch with us via social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram @SaverPod. Thank you, as always, to our super producer, Dylan Fagan. Thank you to you for listening, and we hope that lots more good things are coming your way.